sexy nerds of the Nerd Imperium. Welcome to this week's episode of the Currently Nerdy Podcast. We are your inner conclave of nerdom. My name is Diz, and I am your pop culture and sports nerd. Ali?
I am Ali, your classic nerd.
And I'm V, I'm your comic book nerd.
Before you start your topic, as the sports nerd, I gotta say, hashtag all caps, go DC. We finally won a fucking title, and you could take it from wherever you want.
What did you win?
The Washington Capitals won the Stanley Cup.
Hockey.
No one plays hockey. No one pays attention to hockey.
The city of DC paid attention, all right? For the first time in 44 years since the team has been around, they won the trophy.
Is hockey a sport?
It is.
It is a sport.
Yeah. It's huge, bro.
Ovechkin.
Ovechkin. Are we going to like cancel hockey now because we're in a fight with Canada?
No, when are we in a fight with Canada?
We are in a fight with Canada.
But no.
Yeah, we're upset about milk or right?
We're pissed off at Justin Trudeau for backstabbing us. Larry Kudlow got a heart attack after saying that, for the record.
What?
Did you guys know that? No. So Donald Trump went to the G8 summit, which should really be called the G7 plus one, as people have been saying.
Is that the picture of him looking like a petulant child?
So he went there and they confronted him about his tariffs. So the fact that, now, one of the misunderstandings of tariffs and what's going on currently is the idea that somehow the United States has been victimized by tariffs. Other people have been put there. But the actual reality is the tariffs have been proportional. It's 1.8 across the board. 1.8 for us. We charge 1.8. That's standard. Europe, Japan, I think Japan is the only one that's like 1.6 or 1.7, right?
Because they export a lot of cars.
These are the facts, right? Numbers don't lie. Trump, however, has kind of managed to get into his head that somehow we've been screwed by tariffs, or at least this is the red meat he's selling his base. And so he's decided that he's going to slap on more tariffs, mostly on Canadian products. He's decided to go have a fight with Canada.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Which is a stupid move, because Canada is a very close trading partner of ours.
Yeah, they're America's hat, as you put on your hat.
Yeah, they are America's hat. And not only are they America's hat, but Canada and the United States have a very unique relationship. I mean, whatever you feel about American imperialism and whatnot, you have to acknowledge that after 9/11, literally on the day of 9/11, there was 178 roughly flights in air with nowhere to go, and Canada took them all in, housing roughly about 10,000 Americans in Canada until the FAA could figure out how to reroute things and bring people back home. Open their arms, you know, no hesitation.
Come
whatsoever.
On in, neighbor.
I mean, there's moments like maple there's a lot syrup. Of things. Let's not, you know, romanticize Canada. They've got their flaws, you know, four just one in Ontario, right? So there's all sorts of things like we can call out as problematic, but on a whole, they've been good neighbors. So he's decided that he's going to slap on these tariffs. And so Canada responded in kind. Canada goes, okay, we'll slap tariffs on steel, which we can't afford. If they do that, it'll cripple our steel industry, right? It's a bad, especially considering that things with Mexico are not looking well. Mexico have decided that they're going to do their agriculture and car deal with Argentina now, completely cutting us out of the deal. This is a $20 billion loss for us, for the record.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so
that's cool.
So in addition, all the world is kind of going, Trump, what are you doing? You've lost your damn mind. And it's all come down to this thing called tariffs. He's now in a trade war with Justin Trudeau. And
he's upset because he's better looking than he is.
I think that's what he feels, deeply insecure. He left the deal really, the G8 summit early because he got angry and he was petulant and he left and he went to Singapore for the Trump-Kim summit or the North Korea summit.
I like to say, I prefer to say it was the Trump-Kim-Rodman summit, because dear Lord, did Rodman go in there and he cried his eyes out, but that was the passion.
Others have called it the Trump-Kim-Rodman circle jerk.
Yes, of course, the okie cookie.
I mean, there's no better person for foreign diplomacy than Dennis Rodman. The man who kicked a nice little journalist in the balls because he fell into him when he was going for a rebound. Mind you, the guy didn't do anything wrong besides doing his job and sitting there trying to record the thing, so he kicked him in the balls.
Incidentally, Rodman was part of the NWO and WCW also.
That's true.
Connection? I think so.
New World Order. Should point out that we're apparently about to be in a trade war with Canada, and we're making buddy buds with North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, if we cancel hockey, it's cool, because then the Capitals will be the last chance.
That's the end of the hockey, right?
Yeah, we'll be the last ever champs.
Honestly, though, do you really want that as if white males were ready, like upset. Yeah, but
I mean, remember when France like dared to say something about the Iraq War? We're like, that's it, freedom, no more fries. French fries. freedom fries for like a total of a year, right? Like we were very serious about the freedom fries bullshit.
We were serious about that.
We canceled fries.
Well, that was our senior year in high school. Because remember, there was one guy in our senior class who was like absolutely adored Reagan. Right, he was a Republican, and he started talking about freedom fries and bullshit.
No one.
I have to tell you, without beyond a shadow of a doubt, he was the biggest D-bag that I ever met in my life.
So now we're going to cancel hockey, I'm assuming.
For Canada.
So let's put what happened with North Korea in context.
We're gonna deport George St. Pierre.
This is why people tune into the podcast, so we can give them some information on this instance, right? So this agreement was a little bit touch or miss for a little bit. We weren't sure if it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, Mike Pompeo went over there, and then they finally agreed on the summit in Singapore. One of the richest countries in Asia, for the record.
Yeah, Singapore.
People don't know this about Singapore.
One of the highest rated airlines in the world.
Rated airlines, cleanest city in the world.
You can't buy gum there.
Yeah, they cane you for like stepping on their money.
There's a lot of like kind of some exaggerations on the parts of Singapore. Like, okay, yes, there is a stiff penalty for gums and chewing wrappers and gum, all of it.
Yeah.
They don't cane you for it, okay?
I never said that. He said that.
But that was the thing when we were growing up. It's like, oh, shit, they cane you, right? It's like, no, they happen to be a really interesting country that's kind of a mix of kind of socialism and capitalism.
Hugely multinational.
Very multinational. Yeah. Like they have, for example, all the hospitals are owned by the government.
Oh, nice.
And one of the best healthcare systems in the world. But it's a healthcare system that is still rooted in competition. You have to get a higher rating than your other hospital. So there's an element of capitalism there, right? Yeah. There's a free market, but the government owns a stake in most businesses. Yeah. So, you know, there's a mix of both. Anyway, so the summit was at Singapore. People are going, it's historic. It absolutely is historic.
Yes.
The reason why this happened comes down to South Korea.
Uh-huh.
South Korea basically got rid of their previous leader. And in a massive series of corruption protests that went on for a year until they forced them out.
Now they have Moon.
Now they have Moon. And Moon has really approached North Korea in a different manner about ameliorating differences and trying to resolve it. He was the main impetus for this summit. Now, the Trump administration agreed to the summit. It was considered controversial at first because the North Korean leadership has wanted a summit, a sit down with an American president for probably the better part of 40 years or so, right? Mm-hmm. But the American presidents have not given them that because they don't want to give them any form of legitimacy and because they want preconditions, and one of the preconditions being denuclearization.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump is the first president in decades to officially meet the leader, the chairman of North Korea, shook hands with him, held a press conference with him, got a massive photo op, and in the end, they signed a document. Now, if you were paying attention to right-wing news, you would think that this was the biggest diplomatic accomplishment in the world.
Yeah.
Here's some context for you. The document that they signed is the exact same agreement that North Korea has signed and subsequently violated back in 1997 and 2004 and 2010.
Huh.
So it has signed the exact same verbiage and language roughly about three or four times. And it has done so in the past without any U.S. administration meeting them. In other words, Donald Trump got North Korea to sign a document that they've already signed before, but he gave them what they have never received in the past before.
Which is?
One, he gave them legitimacy on an international stage. They are no longer a rogue state, but a partner.
Yeah.
Two, they gave them a photo op, which is a very important propaganda tool for North Korea. And three, and most importantly, he agreed to cancel the war games with South Korea. Now, he did so without letting South Korea know or our Air Force know. And the first person to announce the end of the war games was actually the foreign minister of China, which tells us that North Korea was so excited about that concession that they literally picked up the phone and called China. He did so.
What's the war games?
War games are a series of defensive kind of shows, if you will, that South Korea and the United States and Japan put on as a way of demonstrating military might and to kind of keep North Korea in check. It's also training exercise to demonstrate coordination so that you can work between three countries or two countries in a rapid way. We have series a lot of troops in South Korea, right?
That I know.
So he basically, then we found this out from China, and he admitted it later, 2 or 3 hours later. Basically, what we're now finding out a day after the agreement is that he, the great deal maker in chief, got the exact same agreement that three previous administrations have got, but he did so by giving away way more than any administration has ever gotten.
Man.
So it's not as historic as people think it is. It's historic in the sense that, yeah, they've certainly met.
Historic fuck up.
Like, yeah, they've met and it visually looks nice, but oh my God, it's pageantry. This is one of the worst diplomatic blunders that the Trump administration has made in ever. I mean, the Iran deal comes close, but luckily there's other people in the Iran
deal. Like reneging on
it? Yeah, reneging on the Iran deal. But there's other people who have upheld the Iran deal. This is probably the worst diplomatic blunder they've made. Look, if he can denuclearize North Korea and bring peace, I'm 100% for it, right? I don't care who does it.
Yeah.
But if he's getting the exact same agreement that's already been violated while giving up our ally South Korea and Japan, and promising to wind down troops in South Korea. That's. I mean, this guy gave away it. I mean, for a deal maker.
He literally. I think he signed the what the equivalent is to an Olive Garden's kids menu with a crayon in this situation.
I mean, what it is? It's the equivalent of going in and talking all sorts of smack about a car dealership, right? Be like, I'm going to go in there. I'm going to get the best deal. I'm going to get this brand new car. I'm going to put nothing down.
And they got you
and on it's that 8% APR. And it's going to be like 0.7% APR, and you've come back and you've signed away your house.
Yeah.
And you're on 8% APR.
The package they give me comes with an alarm.
It's got this tracking thing. It's got two keys, one for me and a spare key. And you're just like, bro, that's standard.
I know I said I wasn't going to put anything down, but I put $10,000 down and I'm paying $7,000 a month.
And you're like, holy Christ, what happened? But I mean, it was no one. And part of the problem was that he took no experts. And so a bunch of these North Korea experts. I have a colleague of mine who works on Japan and North Korea, specializes in the history of it, is actually also a cartographer, interesting enough.
Map maker.
Yeah, very few people who study maps. There's still a few of us that still study map. I'm not one of them.
Are the people that work for Google Maps considered cartographers?
No, I don't know.
Why not? They make maps.
They're Satan worshippers.
They're what?
Satan worshippers.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
What was I saying?
My
colleagues were sitting there literally just ripping what little hair they had left out, going, why didn't he ask any expert? All the experts want a deal. It's fine. Mm-hmm. They're happy to agree. But like, we could have helped him be like, this is not a good deal. This is what you agree.
Isn't that par for the course, though? I mean, we've seen the strain of anti-intellectualism.
He just decided that he was going to swing it.
Here's the thing, right? When he went to Iran, Obama went to Iran, didn't he bring people with him?
Yeah, he did.
I mean, any president knows that they got to bring experts no matter what.
Yeah, and Obama never went to Iran.
Yeah. But
they met.
Yeah.
I think really what's crazy is that within our own like adult lives and our teenagers, I think we're seeing like these like grand pillars of what like the U.S. stood for in our past kind of being taken away.
Yeah.
Right. Like with George W., we've talked about this plenty of times. George W. Bush.
He means me.
Well, you talked, and I listened.
This is my central thesis. Go on.
Oh, is it your central thesis?
No, but it's a good thesis. Go on.
So the idea that, you know, during the Iraq War, the second one, what it did was all it really did was show the limitations of our military.
Yeah. Right?
Which you've also stated emphatically.
The kind of unintended consequences of the Iraq War was like the desire to demonstrate American militarism ended up.
Why do you keep changing hats?
This one doesn't fit.
Why do you keep changing Canada's?
Put that back on.
The attempt to demonstrate American militarism actually did the exact opposite. It showed the limits of American militarism.
Yeah, and in this situation, it's really kind of showing our, you know, I mean, how horrible our foreign policies are. Or even worse is how horrible how bad we are about negotiating with people. Given that I think Trump seems to respond purely to guys who can sit there and shake their fists at other people.
Or right? And who stroke his ego a little bit. Because, I mean, he literally did tell a dictator who's murdered his own people, He's a nice guy. Smart negotiator. I'm honored to meet you.
I will tell you this right now. All right? I think this is all very... This is all... You know, this is almost... It's almost like prophecy the way it works. Because if you go back to our very first episode, when there was four of us, right? What was... The central theme was the fact that Kim Jong-un needed to get laid. Or was ill that needed to get laid. One of them.
One of them needed to get laid.
Right? But it was... But we were talking about that. And I think it's just really funny that now... We're going to this whole thing where all of a sudden he's getting all sorts of deals and all sorts of bullshit from Donald Trump because of some weird thing where he's sitting there acting as if he's this big badass when in actuality these people are starving. Their economy is literally in tatters. And he literally fucking mortar round his own uncle for not standing long
enough. Yeah, not only did he kill his own uncle, but like this is a guy that they said that Donald Trump goes, oh, his people happen to love him. That's because his people are living in a dictatorship.
Yeah, and they get murdered for not loving him. For God's sakes, it wasn't that long ago where we had that issue with the guy running across the DMZ. Remember that?
The what now?
The guy running across the DMZ. Like, he...
Oh, yeah.
From North Korea, and, like, he was filled with so many damn parasites and rickets and bullshit, right? And then they were also talking about people who defected from North Korea, talking about people were literally living in their own filth, and they were chained up for years for being political dissenters out there, right? We had this whole program where we were sitting there sending bottles of, like, or we were sending, like, secret messages of, like, American TV shows showing North Koreans that life wasn't like that outside of, you know, wasn't the same outside of North Korea to try to, like, build some kind of upswell. Of
yeah, like, and let's recognize, too, is, like you can be against American imperialism like I am while also acknowledging that countries like and recognize that America does do a lot of shitty propaganda while also recognizing that it's simultaneously true that North Korea is a brutal dictatorship. Like we fall into this kind of weird progressive trap sometimes where we go, oh, American imperialism is the worst, but we'll accept Kim Jong-un. It's like, no, you can acknowledge that both of these things are bad.
Yeah,
both of these things are bad things. At the end of the day, I'm hoping for the best. I'm hoping that despite his kind of massive blunder on this instant, that we can somehow, what's a football term? Fumbles the ball. But what do you do? Like
recover the fumble.
You recover. I'm hoping that we can recover the fumble.
You didn't know recover.
I didn't know recover. I knew the word recover meant. I didn't know it was applied to football.
Yes, it applies.
I thought there was like a special term, just like fumble.
No, it's just recover the fumble.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that we can somehow recover this fumble.
I think we should also mention in more tragic news here, you know, the passing of a personal hero of mine. I'm sure you guys also admired him a lot as well, of Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
On Thursday night, Friday morning.
Kate Spade as well.
Kate Spade as well. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's brought up a lot of interesting questions about the nature of American society, right? Mm. And the way that we do things. Just a little insight into what happened there. Anthony Bourdain was found by his friend Chef Eric Repair in his hotel in France, and he had apparently hung himself, 61 years old. And what's crazy is that, you know, more times than not, if you ask anyone what their dream job would be, more times than not people will say they would want to be Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the man did something that, as a travel and food blogger myself, he achieved the life, right?
Yeah.
The one that we all kind of are hoping to achieve one day. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that made him so special is that within travel circles, there's a concept or a language called travelese that they talk about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to the Travel Channel and you watch all these shows, whether it be, you know, Anthony Zimmer, that one Joey Fatone looking dude with the bowling shirt.
Guy Ferrari.
Yeah, him. Right. And then or any of them. Right. They talk about this language called travelese, which is them basically using bullshit terms like hidden gem or, you know, wondrous or authentic. Right. Or all these other things. And when in actuality, it's like they really show such a superficial side of these places. Right.
Uh-huh.
They tend to stay only in areas that are more or less made for white people to feel comfortable. Uh-huh. What Anthony Bourdain did that was so different from a lot of these other people is that he didn't speak that language. He talks about how in some places, like when he would go to the biggest shithole cities in places that people normally wouldn't travel to, and he would talk about the struggle.
Use the Donald Trump word.
What, shithole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I did use a Donald Trump word. He would go to these, but he actually called them shithole. He would go to cities that were devastated by things like colonialism, or devastated by opioid crises, or you know, drug problems. He went to Mexico to talk about drug cartels while trying their food as well. He tried to show the truth about the culture and why those truths ultimately created the cuisine that it did.
Yeah.
One of my most favorite quotes by him was actually he went to Buffalo, New York, and he actually said, "If you want, if Al Roker will fucking talk to you about Buffalo wings, I'm here to talk about other things from Buffalo." Right. Mm-hmm. In 2014, he had an episode where he went to like a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and he talked about the first time that he shot up.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he had looked at himself in the mirror, and it was narcissism that got him to quit because he hated the way that he looked when he shot up,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, that's a reality that you're not going to see anyone else within that sphere talk about.
Yeah, there is an authenticness to Anthony Bourdain that a lot of people didn't realize, and I think that's what I appreciated the most about him, is he was very authentic about his struggles and his difficulties, and he's very open about struggling with depression for many years and struggling with addiction and substance abuse and whatnot. But his authenticity really lent itself in the kind of language of also the Me Too movement.
Yeah. Right?
He was a guy who admitted that he was once one of those guys.
Yeah.
And he was very publicly doing that kind of emotional labor of untangling that, undoing that, and really becoming and really transforming himself into an ally. I mean, he was such a strong voice during the Me Too movement, lambasting both Harvey Weinstein and Donald Trump both, really standing by his girlfriend Asia, and really kind of being the ally that women needed at a time, while acknowledging that it was a process for him, that he was learning, and it was unlearning of behavior. And I think that in many ways was an example of masculinity that people could really aspire to. So it wasn't just in ways of food, but it was in the ways he interacted with people that made him so.
Yeah.
And the way he interacted, or at least talked about himself, that made him so admirable. And I think for me in particular, because I'm a big fan of Anthony Bourdain like yourself, is that you recognize that, one, all of his shows are mini essays.
They are.
Right? So, like, you watch Parts Unknown, The Layover, they are mini essays. And in them, he's not just introducing people to food. A lot of food places do that. A lot of food bloggers, a lot of food shows do this. These kind of travel. Oh, we're going to try all these diners on this route, right? What he does is he instead tries to take that which is familiar and make it unfamiliar, right? To show you the sides of our society that we don't always look at. Like, for example, he went to Buffalo. He's not going to show you the stuff in Buffalo you already knew about, give you this kind of blasé. But at the same time, he would also reverse that principle to go to those areas in which we were unfamiliar and make it thoroughly familiar. He was at home on a plastic chair at a mom and pop shop on the side of the road. Yeah. Eating noodles. I mean, that's where he took the president of the United States of America.
Yeah.
A noodle shop sitting on plastic stools in Vietnam.
It was in Vietnam.
And it's like one of those moments where you just go, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. And he did so without ever otherizing people, without ever exotifying people, without essentializing people. There was no Orientalism in his approach, because part of the kind of travel journal and the travel dialogue comes out of Orientalism, right? This intellectual desire to know the other, but it simultaneously reifies the boundaries between the self and the other, right? The other is always completely different than you.
Yeah.
He didn't do that. What he did is he showed you how to live that life. I mean, Brazil, he's catching fish and eating it right there on the beach. And he's at home there.
Uh-huh.
He's not at going to five-star restaurants. He's not going to these high-end restaurants. He's at home with the people.
Yeah, so I wasn't as big of an Anthony Bourdain fan as you two were.
Yeah.
I did see him live when I went to Jimmy Kimmel. He was my favorite part of that episode that I went and saw. But his death kind of got to me because of the response to it.
Yeah.
So with his passing and with Kate Spade passing, both of them, you know, committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people posted things like, you know, like, hey, like, if you guys need somebody, reach out. Like, you could reach out to me. Or they were posting, like, the National Suicide hotline number. And then there was a response from other people, right? Like, you know, about mental health. Like, it's... You can't expect people to reach out to you. You should reach out to them.
Mm.
And I kind of get both sides of that argument, right? Yeah. Like, it's tough. For a lot of people that are dealing with, like, mental health issues, it is, like, it's weird coming to somebody else about it, right? Like, you don't want to, like, burden anyone else with, like, your problems. So it's going to be tough for them to reach out. But at the same time, if you're that person, like, you don't want to overextend yourself and like reach out to somebody because you don't know what they're feeling, right? And you're not qualified to help them sometimes, right? Like, I'm not a licensed therapist. I can't. I don't want to give someone the wrong advice and then that turn around and bite me in the ass.
It's a dangerous burden to take on, right?
Yeah. So
you can end up doing more damage than good.
And it's, I think what we really, one of the things that pissed me off was, so I saw a post from one of my friends who's a father and someone who, you know, like tried to take his life at one point. And he called Bourdain a coward for doing what he did, right? Mm. He's like, you know, like as a father, and as someone who's attempted suicide, now that I'm a father, I can never do that.
There's a guy on Twitter that did that too, and he got lambasted. Mike, leave it, or whatever it was. He said some really horrible things, and Twitter just ripped him to shreds.
Yeah, and the thing is like, we don't know what Anthony Bourdain or Kate Spade were going to, right? Yeah. Like, they both had, like, young children that they loved, and, like, you know, I know Kate Spade wrote a note to her daughter, and I think, I don't know if Bourdain did as well to his child, but I know Kate Spade, when she wrote like that note, like, yeah, it sucks for her daughter that she lost her mom that in that way. But when you're battling like things like mental health and depression, you know, like every day is a struggle.
Yeah. And I think the conversation online about mental health is a conversation that needs to happen, but it's also a conversation that ends up being without a lot of nuance.
Yeah.
This is a conversation that's generally better done in other outlets and avenues. I think online, there's a certain kind of performative component to the
online
conversation that ends up, I think, simplifying it. Like, if you're suffering, reach out. Well, you should be reaching out. Like, that, those are kind of, that binary isn't the only options that exist,
yeah.
Right? So, for example, I'm as a college instructor, one of the things that we deal with is we deal with people who have mental health issues or crises or emotional problems, and we recognize that we simultaneously are their support, but also that we're limited, that we are not the experts, and we refer them to people who can help them. But that in of itself can be problematic. That can be a problem, right? Some people aren't comfortable reaching out in that way.
Mm-hmm.
This conversation, I think, is an important one to have, and I think it's one that's desperately needed. I think it's one that the online world isn't the best place to do it at, in my humble opinion.
No, I agree.
I think the online world is good at raising awareness.
Yeah.
There is a crisis going on, right? But also an acknowledgement that these conversations have to then go elsewhere. Because, I'm sorry, a Facebook thread, a Twitter thread, it just doesn't do it.
It doesn't do anything at the end. It doesn't. Like, I talked about Travelies earlier when we were talking about Anthony Bourdain. It's a whole lot of empty words, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And more times than not, it's there to serve, not so much as a service to other people, as much as it is a lip service to yourself. I think there's a component of narcissism that kind of comes with that too, right? This idea that somehow, like, I'm not going to disparage anyone's struggle, because everyone's struggle is their own.
Yeah.
But the problem here is that when you're using, or when you're taking advantage or exploiting Anthony Bourdain's pain and his ultimate demise as a way for you to somehow assure yourself that you're doing okay in that sense, or that you somehow did the right thing by not killing yourself, I think I have a problem there with that.
This is one of those areas where I think a lot of people have opinions, but they also should recognize that their opinions in this matter are limited and restricted by their lack of knowledge.
Uh-huh.
Right? That you could be well-intentioned, but you end up doing more damage than good.
Yeah.
And so this is why I'm one of those people that thinks you can use social media for awareness. This is not where that conversation needs to be taking place, simply because, or if it is, it needs to be taking place by people who are willing to do the work.
Yeah.
And I don't think people are willing to do that type of work.
I don't think
online.
They're qualified.
And that, I think, leads to some problems, right? Like, I think seeing those Twitter threads or Facebook threads with some of these conversations can be deeply emotionally traumatic for some people, can be triggering for some people. And so I think I'm one of those people that kind of stayed away from the social media world while this was going on, because I went, just don't want to see it. Don't want to see it. It's not worth it. It's not worth going down that route. And it's crazy. What you can do, however, is acknowledge that resources exist.
Mm-hmm.
Support systems exist.
Yep.
There are things that we can all do. And I think part of the struggle with suicide has always been that there are warning signs, but we miss warning signs. And so when we miss those warning signs, we try to reassure ourselves that what happened was unexpected.
Yeah.
Came out of nowhere. No one could have predicted this. No. The reality is that there were warning signs. You missed them. And that's okay.
Yeah.
All of that is true. Mm-hmm. Right? There were warning signs that you missed them, and that's okay. We're human. There are errors that happen. But that there are support systems, and there are resources, and there are means of dealing with all of this. And that this is a conversation that I think our society needs to really go through as part of a broader, holistic reexamining of, I think, structures, right? Structures of health, notions of health, notions of success. For example, I saw this conversation talking about how they found that white, successful, wealthy individuals were more likely to commit suicide versus brown thing. And poor. And they were like, oh, well, that's because brown people are more resilient, not recognizing that their entire framework there is capitalism, that they're defining success as wealth, and poor people aren't successful, therefore but somehow they don't commit suicide. But there are other forms of success that exist that people might achieve, fulfillment, etc. That it's not just, oh, well, poor people are poor, but somehow because they're poor, they're resilient. There's a weird kind of capitalist framework.
Yeah, they're too poor to kill themselves because they realize that they can't put their
families in. And there is an acknowledgement to recognize that there is a component of, I think, ethnic experience, if you will, right? That the privilege does play a role in this. Minority communities often don't have the privilege to see, you know, well, I guess privilege may not be the wrong, but perhaps the POV to see the world through the lens of an individual, but rather see it as a network of individuals, right? So even the loneliest brown person is still part of a broader social network that may come with responsibilities and whatnot. That can be both a blessing and can both be a burden and whatnot. So I think, yeah, there can be a dynamic there that you can acknowledge that, okay, there's clearly something going on amongst the white upper class, right, wealthy class, without flattening that experience as going, oh, well, white people are privileged and therefore they kill themselves. No, I mean, it's more complicated, and mental health is more complicated. It's not that poor people can't afford to kill themselves. Or poor brown people can't afford to kill themselves. That's a really flattening way of looking at it that takes capitalism as the core perspective, and instead to acknowledge that this is clearly more dynamic mental and emotional health
the
issue.
The human mind is so complicated.
It's way more complicated.
So you can't you can't think of it in that juxtaposition.
Yeah, you can't think of these weird binaries, these simplistic fashions. And then again, you have to acknowledge that when you're talking about something of this sensitive nature, you simply don't have the experience to talk about it. We don't. We have to acknowledge that even every bit of our opinion is our opinion, and it could be deeply flawed. And, you know, this conversation is triggering. And so we are going to put trigger warning in our description just to let people know in advance that we're having this conversation. But clearly this is a conversation that needs to be had. How it's going to happen, I don't know.
So let's kind of cleanse the palate here for a second.
Cleanse the palate.
Hmm. You know, in terms of Marvel news
or and nerd news,
whatever else, we just saw the premiere of Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Cloak and Dagger
at all. Yeah, very interesting.
I love the idea of it because Cloak and Dagger are you know, they're kind of minor players in the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
I love Cloak and Dagger as a kid. Mostly Cloak, because his ability is essentially his cloak can create mass teleportation, so he teleports anywhere.
Huh.
So in Civil War, he would teleport. I think it's Iron Man's.
He also reminds me of a particular beast that we found in the show Beastmaster, where they would envelop people and swallow them whole with their wing.
I love the idea because there's something that's very characteristic of this. Like,
I like the partnership. I like that they're. I know it's nothing of this. That is superheroship that's rooted in them being partners.
Yeah, I love the one thing about this show that I appreciate, and we're seeing this now with Marvel, especially on their television series, is that they're kind of delving into much more kind of young adult, the young adult life, but with drama instead of this superhero kind of.
And we're gonna probably see this with the New Mutants as well.
Exactly, and what I think is great is that what they did was, you know, the first two episodes have only aired so far, but what they've done, which is great, is that I think they're attempting to create, or trying to. To showcase kind of the difference in struggles between two people, right?
Yeah.
Technically, Dagger is a white girl who comes from a wealthy family. Her mom has issues with pills. Mm-hmm. Her dad dies during an explosion of a rig, etc. And then she, in turn, goes to rich people's parties and steals from rich people.
Yeah.
And also herself has a drug issue.
Yeah.
Whereas Dagger's origin comes from, he lives in the
city. You mean Cloak.
Excuse me, yeah, Cloak. Whereas Cloak's origin story lives in the city with his family, right? Now, his brother, you know, is kind of is older, is kind of his you know, is kind mentor. Of his, the guy he's looking up to, right? Yeah, his mentor. And he ends up being shot by the cops out of a big misunderstanding.
Oh, hey, what's new?
And then what's going on here, which is interesting, is what they kind of turn this, is that Dagger's family now is, they are living in, you know, he goes to a private school, they're living in an upscale neighborhood because his family, his parents were able to kind of push them into this other part of society. He himself feels like a bit of an outsider in the private school that he's going to, right? Whereas she is now living in an abandoned church.
Yeah.
She's stealing money from people. She has all this other stuff.
They also have a very interesting relationship between the two of them. They end up, because at times they're always partners, but sometimes they're physically like lovers, and sometimes they're not. They're just friends. But the relationship is also deeply dependent because Cloak has a hunger.
Yeah.
Right? To consume, and it, daggers, like daggers, seem to be one of the few things that he can feed off of, without, you know, consuming other things. So there's this weird kind of dynamic between the two of them that I'm interested to see if the show is going to explore. But the comic books have always been quite fascinating.
I'm really excited to see where it goes. It's a little bit darker, which is kind of cool.
How many episodes have there been?
It's only two episodes in, but there's a scene where, you know, where Dagger actually finds her powers while she's about to get, you know, she's getting sexually assaulted in an alleyway by a rich guy, and her power manifests, whereas Cloak's power manifests like during where he sees the cop that killed his brother, right? Or, you know, other things like that, and it kind of comes out of this weird maturation, puberty.
Yeah, it's a coming of age.
Is it worth the watch?
It is, absolutely.
I think this is the direction. This is a very smart direction for Marvel to take, because a lot of superhero stories in general are actually coming-of-age stories. And while we've started in kind of the adult comic book world, tapping into the older fan base, by moving in, I think, vis-a-vis Spider-Man Homecoming first, and then now Cloak and Dagger, New Mutants, and even the other show...
Runaways?
What's it called? Runaways. These are all, I think, really good moves to now bring in a younger audience to tap into that kind of tween audience that at the end of the day is commercially going to be successful for them, but also can start telling the stories that are at the heart of comic books, that is not just good and evil, big epic battles, but coming of age stories of what it means to live in society growing up. That's a lot of superhero stories.
This is TV 14 too, so it's a little bit older, which is great.
I'll check it out when I get home tonight.
So you know, I wanted to bring a Patronus.
Yeah, let's end on a Patronus.
Yeah.
Currently going to do Patronus.
In our halls of Patronus.
I don't know what they're... That was a side effect.
We don't have a side effect.
Listen, we'll find one, okay? But here's the thing, okay? Now, I have to say, I've been to Florida once, didn't much care for it, too humid.
Nope.
It's a shithole.
I would get rid of that state.
It's a shithole.
Put a bunch of TNT along the border.
Miami, Orlando, and Tampa.
I would only put a bunch of TNT on the border, blow it up, and push it out into the water.
So as Homer Simpson said, Florida is America's Wang.
Yeah. America's toilet.
Yeah.
Like, America's syphilitic Wang.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. Doesn't look right.
Yeah. The people there don't look right either.
I don't hate on Florida that much. Florida's got weird shit. You know, their legal law, you know, Florida man. Yeah. The reason why there's so much stuff with Florida Man is because all their legal records are public. So that's why we see so much shit going on in Florida, is because they literally can't hide anything from the rest of the world in terms of like shit that's happening.
Yeah, their blatant racism, all that stuff.
Now, Patronus.
I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of alligators myself. They're one of my favorite animals, right? Uh-huh. If I had a Patronus, an alligator would be one of them. Oh, I know Sobek, this Patronus. Right? Sobek, the Egyptian god, right?
You don't get a Patronus who's a god. You just get the animal.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter.
Just clarify.
I am fine with an alligator.
My Patronus is Jesus.
V, your Patronus would not be an alligator, bro. Let's be honest. It'd be a snapping turtle.
Okay, go on.
It doesn't matter. Okay, so now if there's a video went viral this weekend as well, right? It's marvelous. Yeah. So an alligator got caught in Florida. Big old. It looked like a 9-footer.
Huge
alligator, right? And he was in the suburb.
I've seen this.
Yeah.
And what's great is that. So they call Animal Control.
Oh, I saw this too.
And then they type. This poor alligator is tied up. He's hot. Like they're about to put a stick through the thing and cook him over an open fire, right? Now the one thing that we always appreciate on this podcast,
poetic justice.
It's poetic justice, and also the the indomitable spirit to survive.
Yes,
and to lash back against the man.
Yes.
Now, if you see some of the context of this video, right, the trapper who ends up tying him up, he's sitting there, he's kind of hitting his face and everything.
Yeah, he's slapping the face.
You know, kind of giving him a little like diz when
he's showing off to the cops.
You know, going, okay, it's cool, it's cool. So then they all try to haul him on the back of a truck. mm-hmm. right? This alligator goes Super Saiyan mode and then goes quack, right? And knocks the trapper out. Yeah. His fucking sunglasses fire off into the distance.
Yeah, he swings his head back and headbutts the trapper.
So, like, if you've seen that fight, Alistair Overeem versus Francis Ngannou, think of that, right?
Because he knocks that guy clearly out. Yeah.
And that tail starts whapping at police officers, right?
And falls out of the truck.
That's right, dude. They literally said they Kaepernick slapped these people. Like
He without a shadow of a doubt. God, he waited. He's like, "You slap my face, all right? I see.
Yeah, you son of a bitch.
Show off. Go ahead." And the second he got a chance, pow! That's a good one. That's a good.
This alligator has now been immortalized within the Carlinori Patronum.
That
alligator
entered the halls of Patronum.
That alligator gets treated as most black people do by the cops in Florida.
Okay, well you took it in a weird direction.
I didn't.
All right, Diz. Why don't you take us out, people? Let us know what you thought about our conversation. We had a kind of an uneven tonally conversation because a lot of weird things happen on one. And you had the absurdity of the Trump-Kim summit. You had the kind of really sad and tragic news of Anthony Bourdain. And then, of course, the exciting news of Cloak and Dagger. Let us know what your thoughts are about this. Are we ready to have a conversation about mental health? Is this really an area that we continue? Why is it that we continue to struggle with this conversation? Not just the issue. The issue is perpetual. But mm-hmm. the issue, just discussing it, why is it still a bit of a problem? Yep. Is it stilted by social media or is it helped by social media? Let us know your thoughts about the Trump-Kim summit. Are you excited? Are you looking forward or hopeful for the future? Do you think it's all going to go to shite? And of course, what are your thoughts about Cloak and Dagger? Are you excited about it? Do you think that this is in the right direction for Marvel to go in, or do you have other thoughts? Diz, let them know how they can get in contact with us.
Yes, Facebook.com/currentlynerdy, Twitter @currentlynerdy, Instagram @currentlynerdy, Tumblr currentlynerdy.tumblr.com, YouTube, search for us under Currently Nerdy. We're on Stitcher, Google Play, and the iTunes podcast app. Search for us under Currently Nerdy. Give us a 5-star rating and subscribe, please. And if you already subscribed, make some of your friends subscribe to us. If you want to get a hold of us individually, you can. V, how can I get a hold of you?
You'll find me on my Twitter and my Instagram at VTran214. That's VYTRAN214. So find me on my websites at 7crossroads.com and thesandwichslayer.com. Ali?
You can catch me on my website at AliOlomi.com or on Twitter and Instagram at AAOLOMI. I'd love if you can give me a follow. Or on our sister podcast, Head on History, Diz.
You could find me everywhere at Dizbulla, DizBullah.
For everyone here at Currently Nerdy, thank you for tuning in. And remember, stay smart, sexy nerds.
And we love you even more if you're an alligator hitting cops.